Gosh.
Even though it's nighttime?
This would
Okay.
be an experiment, I guess. Okay, I'm getting
In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. Whatever the virtues and the many fields of knowledge, all our steps on the path to omniscience, may these arise in the clear mirror of intellect. O Manjushri, please accomplish this. So I've muted you all, but if you want to chime in, just unmute yourself or raise your hand. And tonight we start with on page 199. Of our resourceful book, Dissentress Have a Thesis and Position. And if you were at all like me, I spent quite some time reading through this, thinking it was sort of redundant and repetitive. And why were they being so apologetic and defensive? Like, was somebody attacking them? And then I realized that, okay, it's the setup for going into the explanation or the exploration of the arguments for emptiness, the reasonings for emptiness. An idea, and so I think the idea is before going into those reasonings, we have to have some understanding of like how those reasonings function as skillful means, as relative means to transform our mind, and that we're not taking those reasonings as proving anything or disproving anything or having a, using the formal terminology as these reasonings. We're not taking a stand on anything, on reality one way or another, nor are we undermining some true reality. We're using the words purely for skillful means, purely as a way to try to help our minds understand the way we conceive of reality and shift that understanding. And that process, as we know, is the threefold process, the three prajnas. Of hearing or studying, reading the words, hearing the words, hearing the ideas, reading the ideas, contemplating them, grappling with the notions being presented, challenging them, trying them on forwards and backwards, see if they fit, put them through the washing machine, see if they still fit, and then, meditating upon them. So meditating upon the result of the reasons doesn't mean that you come to some conclusion about the way things are or aren't, but that you release your mind from believing that things are some way or are not some way. So I think that's the entire purpose of this whole number of pages of like, do we have a thesis and the different types of centrists and how they approach their argumentation and so on and so forth. So I'm going to go through those sections rather quickly and then spend the most of our time going through the steps and the reasoning, and then we'll use that in a contemplation. Using the little text by Atisha that I circulated. And I'll share that on screen for those that don't have that. And I can share it again to those that didn't get it after class. So let's see. on page 2001, on the bottom, the problem with inherent existence. It's always a red flag when people start off by pointing out problems with things instead of taking a positive point of view and looking at the opportunities. But you gotta cut them some slack and go with it a little bit. So it says, any objection to emptiness or the lack of inherent existence of phenomena would be intended to establish that something is not empty. Something like me or you. That is, that it has inherent existence. If something is to be proven as inherently existent, it may be assumed to be established in one of two ways. On the one hand, we might think that it's inherently existent on its own, by its own power. And it's by itself that it's to be completely independent of other causes and conditions. And the problem here is that this presupposes what has to be proven in the first place, inherent existence. This is sort of a circular and avoids the issue of what is inherent existence and how could something have that. Alternatively, if something is claimed to have arisen from something else that is inherently existent, then the inherent existence of the something else would have to be established, which entails the same problem. So all of this boils down to that if we're going to try to prove something as being inherently existent, as not empty, then you have to assert inherent existence from its own side, so to speak. Let's see. I'm gonna sort of skip the parts about whether centrists have theses or not, thesis or not, because many of them write dissertations or theses. There's been probably hundreds of theses written on emptiness if you go through the database of PhD theses. So I'm just not even going to touch that one, but the crux of the matter is on page 203, where he points out that to the extent that anybody has a thesis at all about things either being inherently existent or most commonly this thesis that, okay, everything is empty, and like emphatically believing, asserting, proving that things are empty, then you're really just lost. Just sorrowfully, totally lost. So at the end of this section that ends on 203, just before the two kinds of centrists, the same applies to reasoning. No matter how excellent reasonings or theses are that establish through valid cognition, that are established through valid cognition by me, might be ultimately they conflict with the basic nature and are just the road to perdition. In other words, the whole process is to undo the habitual pattern of coming to a conclusion about the way things are and being able to have a mind that is flexible and open and relaxed and not defensive, has no ground to protect, no ground to establish. Ground meaning no assertion of things being one way or another. So when you have, when you get together someday finally for Thanksgiving dinner with your relatives, and they start quizzing you about the religious cult you're into and what Buddhism is and why do you meditate and sit there and do nothing, waste your time meditating. What is emptiness? Try to remain jovial and focus on the cranberry sauce and the gravy or the stuffing and try not to like a search get caught. I think this happens a lot of people when they talk about emptiness in Buddhism, they get caught up in like trying to convince other people about something. And Madhyamaka and the Buddha and all the Buddhas are all about helping people let go of anything that they're convinced about and experiencing kindness and compassion and loving kindness. So that's the sort of preliminary to doing these exercises. They're sort of unexercises in the sense that they're not intended to develop some muscle, some, attainment about the way things are. Let's see. And again, on the bottom, at the end of the section that ends on 204, just above the header called Freedom from Reference Points, this quotation from the first Sanjay Rinpoche, towards the end it says, last sentence or two says, in this state, how could there be any view or meditation of our own system? Once the philosophical system that is our own system has vanished, it's meaningless to refute other systems. Therefore, don't even use the label of Madhyamaka. And so this is addressing the way that many times me, I guess I'll speak for myself, I'll use terminology and labels and say, well, the middle way of the Buddha means this. And you've immediately stepped in dog shit and you need to take off your shoe and clean it off or something. Before you come in the house, preferably. Okay? So, then we have the age-old argument, which we've seen a number of different times, between the three different types of Madhyamakas, the Svatantrikas, and the Prasangikas, and how they're not that different, and they should try to get along and not dwell on their differences, but dwell on their commonalities. On page 205, let's see. Actually, I'm sorry. Let's keep it even more of that and try to get right to the point, which starts on207. At the very top, it says it's important to clearly note that having no thesis or reference point is not just a clever or elusive move in debate. Rather, its main significance lies in its soteriological effect, in that it supports liberation from any clinging and the afflictions that ensue from clinging. And he quotes Nagarjuna. As he's given all sorts of quotes, which is the standard sort of defensive way of going about this process of having to support different absent non-positions with quotes that support, that reiterate the idea of not having a position that needs to be supported with quotes. And then, but it's a good quote. It's a good quote. For the second paragraph of the quote says, those whose minds are not moved, not even by a flicker of a thought about complete voidness, emptiness, having crossed the horrifying ocean of existence that is agitated by the snake, sorry, have crossed, that is agitated by the snakes of the afflictions. So not even to like have an idea that things are empty. So on the very bottom of the page, the last paragraph says, actually, as explained above, the sensuous approach is not even a negation of something. If one could observe even the mutest existent phenomena to be negated, it would certainly be appropriate to negate it. However, if one cannot observe anything to be negated, who would want to speak of negating? What would be the whole point? And then continuing on page 28, it basically summarizes this long lead-in section, and then we'll get to the structure of the non-debate, non-approach. In his famous book called The Entrance Gate for the Learned, Sakya Pandita gives the following example. Just negating while not asserting anything as a kind of deceitful tactic may be compared to not acknowledging that a theft has been committed. So he's referring to Bhava Viveka's critique of Buddhapalita. Bhava Viveka says that for Buddhapalita to just like repeat absurd consequences without putting forward any sort of positive statement about the true nature of reality being empty is elusive in a sort of misleading way. But he says, on the other hand, consequentialists, meaning prasangikas, their negation and assertion is like not acknowledging the not acknowledgement of a theft, and no theft has been committed in the first place. So he's countering this, and he's saying, Buddhapalita, he didn't have to acknowledge or not. The fact that he didn't acknowledge that something didn't happen was correct. Nothing ever happened, so why did he have to acknowledge it? Nothing was ever not empty. Nothing ever became empty. So why do you have to prove it or assert? Anyway, nevertheless, conventionally speaking, Christopher,
This has always felt like a hidden thesis to me, like an unspoken thesis. Like by not doing ontology, they are indirectly doing ontology.
But isn't the key that they're trying to do it as opposed to talk about it, that they're trying to actually experience it?
I guess so, but what I'm trying to say is that they, by rejecting the idea of ontological commitments or ontological truths, that itself is a position, which is to say the position is no ontological truths are possible.
But this quote addresses what you're saying. If there was no ontological statement that was avoided, then what harm is there in avoiding it? I agree with you. You know, it has this whole nuance, which is why Dr. Bernholtzl goes on, you know, for pages, and he's just mimicking the whole tradition that does the same thing, this sort of apologetic of, and what I sort of glossed over is that on the one hand, there's this sense of not having any thesis, not putting forward any view of things one way or another. But then he points out that yes, then they do say here in many places, they do say all phenomena are empty of a nature or have the nature of being empty. And he says it's couched, it all comes down to skillful means. What's helpful in letting go of the fixation that produces defilements, the clinging that produces the whole sea of samsara. So the next paragraph, I think in some way a little bit addresses that. So nevertheless, conventionally speaking, from the point of view of delusive appearances or from the perspective of the subsequent attainment that is informed by preceding meditative equipoise. So he's talking about two types of beings. One is me, deluded being who experiences delusive appearances without ever having experienced true meditative equipoise. And the other type of being is those who have achieved true meditative equipoise. In other words, they've experienced the path of seeing in meditative equipoise. But when they arise again, they then experience dualistic appearance. So from these two perspectives, centrists not only follow ordinary common consensus, but they also employ specific Buddhist conventions. They usually go to conventions, except in situations like today, such as the two realities, karma, and the stages of the path. For these are the conventional means to transcend the root cause of suffering, the clinging to mere delusive appearances as real. On the other hand, the consequentialists do not defend such conventions in debate by trying to actually establish or affirm something. Not even emptiness is the expression of the core of their approach, that is, leading others to freedom from reference points, not creating more. So all that centrists say and teach in their communication with others is always applied as a pedagogic tool that is adapted to the individual perspectives of other people. None of this is apprehended or put forward by Mandyamakans as any system of their own in any way. So you could engage in discussions very helpfully of like, what is harmful to other beings, what's helpful to other beings, why loving kindness is so important, and compassion, things like that. But to engage in debates with your family over Thanksgiving dinner about like the relationship between the mind and the brain, after explaining that in Buddhism, the mind is viewed as being an entity that's separate from the body, and that's how rebirth occurs, is that the mind continues while the body doesn't, then you're in really, really muddy waters, and you better just like go wash the dishes or somehow get out of the room really quickly. So let's cut to the chase here, go right to the pumpkin pie. I don't know why I'm fixated on Thanksgiving here, it's only March. Only been a couple of weeks. Cold up here in my little house. It's like the rest of you guys. Let's go to illusory lions killing illusory elephants. Very violent title or very violent section of the text on page 211.
Can I just say?
Yeah, for sure, Henriette.
The one thing that strikes me in terms of what Chris was saying is this phrase that you mentioned before in that paragraph. Is there a lot of feedback?
No, just a tiny bit. It's
okay. Leading others to freedom from reference points and not creating more. I guess that's sort of what the crux of it is for me is our discursiveness. You know, he refers to discursiveness later on more and more about our minds and their natural state of discursiveness. So maybe, I don't know, this idea of not creating more sort of strikes me at what they're really trying to do there is not create more confusion.
Yeah, that's a really nice way of putting that. Chris, do you resonate with that, not creating more reference points?
I agree that that is their intention. And it feels a little bit like wishful thinking is, I guess, the point I'm trying to make.
Who are they? And
the Madhyamakan, the centrists. Those,
who are they?
Those dang centrists.
Where are they? You know, it's like when you watch Trungpa Rinpoche teaching, if you've ever done this, and if you haven't, I encourage you to. A lot of times in the Q&A, people will ask a range of questions. Sometimes they're very straightforward, sometimes they're convoluted. And sometimes Rinpoche gives straightforward answers that seems to answer the question, but other times Rinpoche gives responses that seem to have no relation to the question, right? Has anyone else ever experienced this, seen this? And, over time or when somebody like I'm about to tells you what's going on is what he's doing is he's answering the person's fixation and not their way of explaining it, not the verbal conventional reference point structure that they're using. And I think that's sort of what Henrietta is also getting to, is not creating more complexity. But I appreciate that the Madhyamakas talk a good talk, and yet they do go on at quite some length. Anyway,
thank you, Eric. That is a great description of what I remember always noticing when he did Q&A, was when he would answer something that was not what was obviously asked, and I would always marvel at what he was doing.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I encourage, you know, check out some videos. Anyway, so jumping right into the structure of the contemplation that we then take into meditation on page 211, he references the opening stanza of Nagarjuna's core fundamental text on the middle way. I bow down to the perfect Buddha, the supreme orator, not the orator, who taught that dependent origination or phenomena that are dependently originated are without ceasing, without arising, without extinction, without permanence, without coming, without going, not different and not one. It is the peace in which discursiveness is at complete peace. Sometimes I think this is translated as the supreme teacher who taught that all phenomena are dependently originated, are without ceasing and without arising, and so forth. Anyway, the crux of it is these four root arguments that Carl lists in the section just below that. And these are arguments. People did argue about these, you know, very heated arguments. First is that outer and inner entities are without ceasing in the end and without abiding in the middle. That's the hard part. They don't even abide in the middle because they don't arise in the first place. I don't know where the first, what this first place is, what that place would be, but I think he means at the beginning. They don't arise at the beginning. Second, outer and inner entities are without extinction because there is no permanence. Outer and inner entities are without coming because going is not established. Outer and inner entities are not established as different because there's no unity that is one. So these are a little abstruse. They're all about outer and inner entities, i.e. phenomena, dharmas, and the terminology of without extinction, because there's no permanence, things like that is a little bit abstruse. So hopefully it becomes a little bit more down to earth and relatable as he goes through the structure of it, and then on the next couple of pages gives an example of how to do this. So let's be patient a little bit and see what he reveals for us. All other Madhyamaka arguments, such as the five great reasonings, derive from these four basic, this fourfold basic structure. It said that the negation of the eight reference points, which are these four arguments, each have two reference points. So that's eight times two, four times two, eight. Eight reference points, arising, ceasing, permanence, extinction, going, coming, oneness, and difference. In the opening verses of the Mula Madhyamaka, Karikas, represents a brief synopsis of both the treatise and centrist reason in general. For the negation of oneness and difference is nothing other than the reasoning of the freedom from unity and multiplicity. While the six other negations of arising and so on primarily depend on the negation of oneness and difference. He's revealing that there's this eightfold scheme that are in four pairs of two each, and they really resolve down to this one scheme of, can you identify something as being either one or many? There are three essential steps in all of these reasonings that analyze for an ultimate inherent existence or inherently existent phenomena or nature within phenomena. First, one picks a certain phenomena, such as a book, and his books were particularly large, so they're very helpful that way. It's like a huge, big tome of a book. As one's basis of attribution or analysis, one searches for a nature of this phenomena that's not self-contradictory. So you have, in order for this to work, that was like a subtle point that you're trying to find some way of understanding the nature of reality that's not self-contradictory. Now, if you're like the type of person that accepts contradiction all the time without any problem there, then it may not hit home for you. You're going to have to like spend a little time working with your mind and say, well, can things really be contradictory? And try to understand, what does this mean, contradictory? Can things exist and non-exist at the same time? Can they be at two places at the same time? Can they be different? Can one thing actually be two things? You know, things like that, and see, like, do I actually believe that things can be contradictory or not? And if you can gradually come to the conclusion that, okay, if I'm going to really understand the nature of reality, I'm going to try to understand a non-contradictory version of that, then I think you go on to step three, which is within this basis of attribution, which in this case is the book, one looks for something such as its attributes that is contradictory to its nature. And let's see how he elaborates on this, and then we'll come back to these three steps and unravel them over and over, or as much as possible. Hence, from among all these arguments, the following two are the main reasonings in that they respectively correspond to steps two and three. So step one is just identifying the phenomena. Step two and three are how you're going to look at that phenomena. First, the reasoning of the freedom from unity and multiplicity in order to analyze the nature. So you say, well, if this thing is a book, it must have a nature of being a book or like many books. And then B, the so-called Vajra sliver reasoning in order to analyze the attributes. So in step two, you've identified a phenomena as being a certain way. And then you're going to compare that to the observable attributes of that phenomena and see if that proposed way of existing that was put forward in step two, or A rather here, actually holds up to the attributes identified by our valid cognition of the phenomena. Many other enumerations of arguments that are explained in these texts are merely branches of these two meanings, in particular the reasoning of the freedom from unity and multiplicity is the root of all reasonings that negates real existence. These are explained in detail below, but to briefly illustrate the above three points, we may start, for example, by taking a book as the object of our analysis when searching for the book's nature. Initially, we might think that it really exists and that it is its nature to be a real unity. So if you say that a book really exists, it must have a nature of being like an identifiable object that has a beginning and an end and a sort of dimensionality where you can say, well, something is on the book and something is off the book, or whether you're touching the book or not touching the book, or whether you're looking at the book or not. whether you're eating the book or not eating it, you know, using your five senses and say, where does the book begin and end, and so forth. When searching for the book's nature, initially we might think that it really exists, and that its nature is to be a real unity. However, such an assumed nature of being a unity is self-contradictory, since a book can be broken down into infinitely many parts. There's the introduction to the book, there's the appendix, there's the glossary, there's the index, there's the table of contents, there's the cover of the book, there's the, you know, the book is just a conglomeration of all sorts of different things. And if you've ever seen how a book is put together, it's sort of neat to help with the visualization. I've never actually seen books put together, but I've seen them fall apart, and I sort of work the way backwards. And, you know, a lot of them are like, there's groups of pages that are woven together, like 20 pages, and then there's like, depending on how big the book is, and with Carl's book, they're huge, there's probably like 100 sets of 20 pages each that are then sewn together. And then they're glued to like this flexible binding that's glued into the, anyway, you get the point, right? But is it just that, like, it may seem simplistic, but you have to acknowledge, you have to sort of have the humbleness to acknowledge that even though we know intellectually that a book is not a unity, that a book is an example for everything in our world, and that we do this all the time, that we have, from the moment we wake up till we go to sleep, and during parts of the night when we're dreaming, we experience the world, our world, as being made up of unities, as units, singular items. And that aspect of reality is a universal aspect that gives us the comfort that we exist. And that is, you know, the root of our fixation and clinging that leads to suffering. So, if we then think that the book must be a real multiplicity, that is also self-contradictory, since we cannot find any real units? Units or unities? I don't know.
Unities. I stumbled over the word building blocks. You know, you hear building blocks of life is a term that we use, you know, and it kind of makes you think that, you know, you can go down to the molecular, submolecular level and find building blocks.
What would it mean to, you know, this has always sort of puzzled me. What is a multiplicity? What does it mean to exist as a multiplicity? Does it mean to have, to possess real building blocks?
Well, that's what it sounds like here.
What would building blocks be in the case of a book? Would it be like a three-part book? A trilogy that like comes in a bind in one of those fancy cardboard things where all three volumes fit in?
No,
is the three of them called a book, or is each one a book?
Yeah, I understand the problem, but that word building blocks makes me feel like you're building something.
Yeah, I always think of this as just about reducing things down to, you know, subatomic particles, and can we find one unit? And if we can't find a unit, then there can't be multiples, because multiples mean multiples of one, and that it all just gets reduced down to that level. That's the way I think of it.
I agree. I think the building blocks refers to that. Does anyone have any other understanding of building blocks in this sense? Or any other reaction to it? I think for us, the multiplicity is just like a non-starter, I find. Because we all immediately say, like, well, if there's no real building blocks.
But I think that it just, you have to have the multiplicity because that's the only other option. You can have one and you can have many. And even though it's a non-starter, you have to kind of acknowledge that as so that it covers all the territory.
Yes, you have to have the pervasion of the possibilities. So is there an implication that there could be like some sort of limited set of real combinations of building blocks, such as we get in our Western atomic table, periodic table. How many elements are there now in the periodic table? Are we up to 113 or 15, 20? Anyone know? Would those be building blocks? But they're building blocks that are made up of other building blocks.
Yeah, you can still break it down further.
Right.
You know, to quarks and then,
quarks,
you know,
yeah.
And nobody even really knows if that exists. And it's still not a partless particle, which is, you know, you can't get any smaller than something that has no parts.
I guess I've always thought that it referred to this notion of there being some relatively, so to speak, finite set of possible combinations. Oh, that's me with of the building blocks, and I've always thought it referred to the Samkhyas, who had some list of like, I don't know, 31, some odd number of like eternal elements, and they combined together to make different things like trees and cars and rocket ships, things like that, even though they didn't have a lot of those at the time. But I don't know that. I think, as Suzanne is saying, it's just like to complete the picture, having the multiplicity as being the unity of building blocks. So why don't we go on? If people have later thoughts about these building blocks, chime in. And since there's no possibility for the book to really exist, you know, again, completing all possibilities, we have to admit, now you don't have to actually, you could just be silent, you don't need to admit it, but he says you have to admit that that the only nature of this book that is not self-contradictory is that it does not exist either as a real unity or a real multiplicity. In other words, the book does not really exist altogether. So we look for positive, possible attributes of the book such that it really arises. Did the book actually get produced? When the book was put together in the way I mentioned, bringing pages together and folding them and combining them and so forth, is there some thing called a book that's being created at that time, or is there some time when the bookness appears, like when the cover is on, or when the spine is, the idea. Anyway. This means that if we were to find some real arising in the book, this would obviously contradict its nature of lacking real existence. to this whole idea of things actually being produced, thereby proving their real existence, is one of the most common exercises that's used in Madhyamaka texts, and which Chandrakirti uses as the main theme of his whole introduction to the Middle Way, is the refutation of the true arising of phenomena in any way, that things are not really produced. And therefore, since things are not really produced, they don't really exist as real independent entities.
Derek, can I ask a question?
For sure.
So something that I've been thinking about or wondering about as we're talking about this is that even beyond the sort of physical attributes that make up what we refer to as a book, I think about, for me, when I think about this stuff, even more so, I think about the fact that just even a book, like, it only is a book because we've all agreed that this thing with a bunch of pages and a bunch of words is something that we're all going to agree is a, like a book and a thing that you read, and it's this thing that we use. And, you know, there was a time in human history when books didn't exist at all. And so it's like beyond the physical attributes of it, can you also do the same kind of analysis with just like the, you know, it's all just like, I don't know, I'm having a hard time describing it, but do you know what I mean? It's
labels.
Like, yeah, the labels and the, you know, the, and I'm thinking about like the words within the book are also just a complete construct, human construct as well. So anyway, I'm just wondering how that fits into this.
It applies to all of this, that the version that I was going through is the most concrete and therefore the most obvious, but there's also the versions of like, what's the difference between a journal and a book and a magazine and a book? And, you know, I mentioned like a three volume book is, you know, so silly things like that. Plus did books not exist before they were written down? You know, like the Iliad and the Odyssey supposedly were repeated for years verbally, and the Buddhist teachings were repeated verbally for years. So did those only become books once they were written down? You know, so at what point is the book created? When somebody like maps out in their mind, if they're actually able to remember the words of a 1,000-page book, you know, in their minds without it being written, is that a book or not? And the Tibetans in the Buddhist tradition is famous for having, you know, receiving texts in whole, you know, texts just like appearing in the mind of these treasure revealers, and then they write it down. And so does the book exist when, you know, it appears in their mind or when they write it down, or did it appear? Anyway, yes, so all of the above. And I think Kevin wanted to add to that.
Isn't that just really a description of concept? That the book is a concept. And the same with building blocks, they're part of a concept. And literally, it just seems to refer to like smaller concepts that are used to make a bigger concept. There's components to make a bigger idea, a bigger concept that we call a building. So let's call those building blocks.
There's definitely, that definitely is correct, yes, that there's the sense of this whole discussion being applied to concepts, as well as this discussion being applied to material phenomena that we apply those concepts to. The nuance is that concepts we all are a little bit more fluid about than not having a true existence, because everybody has their own concept of this or that or what a book is and so forth. But I think the level of fixation on materiality is a little bit more stronger. I remember teaching a class on this once in the Shambhala Center when we did the Shambhala School of Buddhist Studies a couple of lifetimes ago. And there was a guy who was in the publishing industry there. And he argued with me endlessly that a book is a very real thing. And he's seen books being made and gone through the whole process of like scouting the books and working with the authors and bringing them to fruition. And he just wouldn't let go of this idea, you know, both the idea, what Kevin's saying of a book and the physicality of it. And it was like a plant. It was like I had planted somebody in the audience to have that fixed. It was a beautiful thing.
I mean, what's actually cool about that moment is that shows why it's important to talk about the non-reality of material things as it relates to our own suffering. I mean, I feel like that's a perfect example.
Yeah, he was so invested.
Yeah.
With his whole career, and it was like, you can't say that books don't... They changed, you know, the nature of humanity books. Anyway, let's go on here and continue through this book. Okay, so the summary at the end is that books don't really arise. Wait, what is that? It's a rising book. Just kidding. The next paragraph, so I'm going to go through this section, the next few paragraphs in detail, and then we'll pull back. But although the actual centric reasonings always negate, so I'm on 213 the top, their point is not to negate away something that actually exists, since something really existent cannot be negated away. They also do not remove or negate something non-existent. Since a non-existent cannot be an object, there's no object to which to refer in the first place. So negating just means to demonstrate that things do not exist in the real and solid way that we think they do. Thus the object of negation of reasoning, we've spent, you know, many, many classes going through what the object of negation is. And this is a really nice twist on it, is that the object of negation of reason is not something that does not exist anyway. Did I skip something? Let's see. The object of negation of reason is not something that does not exist anyway, such as a truly existing nature of things. Anyway. Technically, the object of negation is merely the mental image that appears for the reifying conceptions of people who mistakenly believe in the existence of what does not exist. Such as the guy in the class who's the publisher, and he's like, books are the most important things in the world. Therefore, as far as Madhyamakans are concerned, real existence is just something that occurs in a psychological or subjective sense, but certainly does not exist in any ontological or objective sense. Thus, or consequently, the force of centrist negation strikes only the realm of our fixed ideas. Let's see, the next paragraph. As for the actual techniques of reasoned analysis, the standard framework of formulating centrist reasonings is to present dilemmas, or even tetralemmas. Might as well go all out if you're going to present the dilemma and go for the tetralemma of mutually exclusive and exhaustive possibilities for something such as existence or arising, which then are refuted one by one. For example, the reason the freedom from unity and multiplicity is presented as a dilemma, that is, really existing things can only exist as a real unity or as a real multiplicity. There's no third possibility, since all existing phenomena are included in those two mutually exhaustive and exclusive and totally exhausting categories of existence. So from the, among the five centrist reasonings, which he'll list in a moment, the three reasonings that negate real arising go even further and investigate four possible ways of arising, such as whether things arise from themselves, from their mothers or others, from both or from neither, which is to say without any cause whatsoever. These four possibilities are mutually exclusive and cover all theoretically imaginable ways in which something might actually appear, come about into existence. Thus, the refutation of each one of these is shown. It was shown that things do not really arise at all, and the same principle is applied to other issues, such as whether a cause produces a result that is already existent, non-existent, both or neither, whether an object exists before or after simultaneously with the consciousness that perceives it, and whether some assumed productive potential in a cause is identical to that cause or different from it. And then finally, on the not so serious side, probably the shortest summary of this approach is to say that the classic Madhyamaka statement to which all others can be reduced is neither nor, nor neither. I thought that was nice, a little touch of humor in this otherwise very serious tone. And then on the top of the next page, so within this framework, it's the actual result, the elimination of reification, not some establishment of any sort of view, but the elimination of reification is the result, can be achieved through either of two means, either through using formal probative arguments, syllogisms, with the three modes, the special three-pronged syllogism of a correct reason, commonly known as autonomous reasonings, or through drawing unwanted consequences from other people's positions, i.e. the Svatantrika or Prasangika methodologies. And on the next page, to conclude this section, that last paragraph before the next header, somewhere like two-thirds through that paragraph on the right-hand side of the page, there's a sentence that starts with, in other words, to conclude, I added that, centrist reasonings beat our fixating mind with its own weapons. So we use the way that our mind works to undo the way that our mind works, ideally. When dualistic mind progressively analyzes its own dualistic structure and function, this inevitably leads to its own demise, its own collapse altogether. When it sees all its reference points dwindle, including itself as that which creates these reference points, it simply goes out of business. So he lists the five reasonings below, the formal version of them, the negation through the analysis of an intrinsic nature, the reasonings of freedom from unity and multiplicity is number one. And when he says the negation through the analysis is the negation of what? Of inherently existent, of inherent existence. Two is through the analysis of causes, the famous Vajra's liver reasoning. The negation through the analysis of results, the reasoning that negates arising of existence and non-existence. Four, the negation through the analysis of both causes and results, the reasoning that negates arising from four different possibilities. And five, the analysis of mere appearances, i.e. the reasoning of dependent origination. So this is the lead in to, he's then going to go through a detailed presentation of these famous five reasonings that we'll go through in the next class. He concludes with giving the necessary were traditionally considered to be necessary support for the five reasonings, i.e. the scriptural sources of where they appear, which I'll skip. And instead, we'll go into, do a little contemplation. And I'm going to share the document that I circulated on screen for us to do that. But first I wanted to show you, there was this reference a couple of times to a famous interchange that happened in during the Buddha's lifetime by, there was a great bodhisattva named Vimalakirti. And he pretended to be sick in order to get the Buddha, or to actually to give the Buddha an excuse to send all of his major students over to Vimalakirti's house for like a Dharma exchange. And turns out to be a very interesting exchange. And it's really a wonderful book. If you're going to read one Mahayana Sutra, you got to read this one. It's called The Holy Teaching of Vimalakirti. I'm going to share screen. And so if you look on pages 209 and 210 of our source book, on 209, the end of the first long quote from Jnana Garbha's Distinction of the Two Truths, it says, in actuality, neither exists. This is the lack of discursiveness. Manjushri asked about actuality, and the son of the victors remained silent. He was stumped. He had nothing to say. And on the next page, the second quote says, therefore, it ends the last sentence, says, the last two says, ultimately, true reality cannot be expressed as the lack of arising and so forth. Therefore, Noble Manjushri asked about true reality, and Noble Vimalakirti said nothing. So just to show you this briefly, it's sort of fun. Oh, let's see. Share screen. How am I supposed to find these things, guys? Help me out. Basic, advanced.
It should be at the bottom. There's something
at the bottom.
Share. It's green.
Right in the middle.
I know. I went into share. Screen. Oh, share screen. Okay. So here's my screen, and can you see my screen yet?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. So here's this encounter. Hold on, sorry. So Vimalakirti, who's a Lichavi, that's a certain town in northern India. So they call them Vimalakirti from Lichavi. He asked the bodhisattvas, good sirs, please explain how bodhisattvas entered the Dharma door of non-duality. So, you know, we talk about different doorways to this and that, and there's the Dharma door. There's different Dharma doors, and the main one for the Mahayana is non-duality. And they each give a very profound response. Production and destruction are two, but what is not produced and does not occur cannot be destroyed. Thus the attainment of the tolerance of birthlessness of things is the entrance into non-duality. This phrase, tolerance of the birthlessness of things, is a technical term. Usually it's called the patient endurance of the uncreated nature of phenomena. And it's an experience that a bodhisattva has at the eighth bhumi. Patient endurance of unarising. And then the next bodhisattva gives another one, I and mine are two. You know, so each of these bodhisattvas give these very very cool, very profound responses. One after another, just a whole bunch of really cool bodhisattvas there. Give these very cool, even Akshayamati, he's famous. There's this famous sutra about him. This goes on for some time. They probably took a break for lunch and then they came back and they probably did it alphabetically. And then finally, they'd all given their explanation. Then they all turned to Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom. I mean, if anybody can nail this question, it's got to be Manjushri. So what is the Bodhisattva's entrance into non-duality? And Manjushri says, good sirs. I don't know why they said good sirs. I guess partially because there were no women there, because they were sort of, that's the way society was back then. But anyway, you've all spoken well. Nevertheless, all your explanations are themselves dualistic. To know one teaching, to express nothing, to say nothing, to explain nothing, to announce nothing, to indicate nothing, and to designate nothing. That is the entrance into non-duality. You know, and everybody went silent and gasped. Whoa, way cool. And then the crown prince Manjushri, turns to the Malakirti and says, we've all given our best shot at this, noble sir. Now you please elucidate the teaching of the entrance into the principle of non-duality. And then the Malakirti kept silent, saying nothing. And they all said, oh my God, that's so profound. You really nailed it. Anyway, there's that. here's like how to practice. And those of you that have done other courses have seen this. It's a very common, for me, text on how to practice the contemplation into emptiness. Because it sums up, it's short, and it sums it up very nicely and succinctly, but not too succinctly. And it follows this pattern that is provided in a great number of greatest hits of the Buddhist tradition, starting with, there's a version Nagarjuna gives in a commentary on the Bodhisattva vow called the Bodhisambhava. And then it's in the Lanka Avatara Sutra. And then it's in Kamala Shila's stages of meditation. And so then Atisha sums it up really nicely here. And so let's read through it once as in a contemplation, and then we'll do it as sort of a guided meditation. So the fifth instruction is on the center. What does he mean on the center? Is he talking about the Shambhala center? Oh, the center, the middle, on non-duality, the Dharma door of non-duality. On the level of the seeming, so on the relative level, in terms of the perspective of those who only see what is right in front of them, that would be me. And this is, by the way, from the book called Straight from the Heart, Buddhist Fifth Instructions, translated and introduced by my guru, Carl. All the presentations of cause and effect and so on explain all phenomena to be real, just the way they appear. We all think that things are as they appear. However, ultimately, actually, on the ultimate level, just this seeming reality as it appears is scrutinized, and thereby done away with the great Madhyama delusion. There's nothing that can be grasped, not even something as tiny as a fragment of the tip of a hair that split 100 times. He's talking about quarks here, and actually string theory. He's referring to string theory when he talks about hairs. There's molecules, atoms, protons, etc., right? this is what you should internalize with certainty. So this is what with certainty we go through initially, we go through the contemplation. So then the logic, sitting on a comfortable seat in the cross-legged position. Now you can sit, you don't have to necessarily do this exactly. You can sit in a half lotus position or an open cross-legged position, or you can sit on a chair. You can also sit on an uncomfortable seat if you prefer that. As a start, let's say that entities are of two kinds, what possesses form and what is without form. But here's a handy way of creating the pervasion of life. Okay, we're gonna look at all phenomena, all things, and how do we sum them up? We sum them up by saying, well, there's basically things that are matter and things that are without matter. What are things that are without matter?
Mind.
So there's mind and matter. What possesses form is a collection of infinitesimal particles. When these are analyzed and broken up in terms of their parts, not even the minutest part remains, and they're utterly without appearance. Now, so very quickly, reducing matter to this, or applying the reduction ad absurdum, or however that's said, to matter. The matter can just be split into parts infinitely, and one will never find an unbreakable, partless particle that forms the true basis of the ultimately real. What is without form is the mind, and the mind has a past mind that's already ceased, and then there's a future mind that hasn't come yet, and then there's the present mind that we can't even find. It's very difficult to examine. It has no color, without any shape. We can't find our present mind. Our present mind is just like space. It's not established. In other words, it's free from unity and multiplicity, free from being one and many. It's unarisen. It's natural luminosity. When analyzed and scrutinized with the weapons of reasoning, such as those just mentioned, you realize that it's not established. So just very quickly in meditation, we just sort of review the analyses of matter and mind, and basically recollecting the conclusion that we've already come to through days and weeks and months and maybe years of contemplating the nature of reality through various means, such as the logical syllogisms and so forth. At the point when those two, form and mind, definitely do not exist and are not established as having any nature whatsoever. And this means at the point when we realize that they don't exist as truly real and don't exist as being truly established as having any nature whatsoever, then we're left with this knowledge that discriminates them. We have this remaining experience of knowing their emptiness. So the third step is realizing that knowing is not established in any way either. That mind that experiences that. For example, if you rub two sticks against each other, fire comes forth. Through this condition, the two sticks are burned and become non-existent. So the two sticks here are first mind that analyzes matter, and then mind that analyzes mind, looking for true existence. And in that process, both the subject and the object disappear, are burned up. Initially, the object is burned up. We sort of burn up fixed ideas about the object, being mind or matter. And then we have to burn up let go of the sort of feeling that there's some perceiver, subject that has experienced this emptiness. Therefore, the fire that has burned them also subsides by itself. Likewise, once all specific characteristics and general characteristics, so sort of real dharmas, or conventionally real dharmas, and concepts, general characteristics are established or understood as being non-existent. Through our prajna, it discriminates individually, item by item. This prajna itself, the understanding itself, is without appearance and luminous, not being established as having any nature itself whatsoever. Thus, all flaws, such as dullness and agitation, are eliminated. Because fixation on anything in any way, it comes accompanied with the flaws of dullness and agitation. Finally, the fourth step is in the interval, in this interval of meditative concentration, consciousness is without any thought. It does not apprehend anything and is left behind all mindfulness and mental engagement. So actually going beyond meditation, experiencing what is later called non-meditation, or in the Mahamudra tradition, non-meditation, where we go beyond mindfulness and experience non-mindfulness. We go beyond mental engagement or attention, and we experience non-mentation, non-mental engagement. And so this fourth phase is just completely letting go of any act, any doing whatsoever. In the third stage, we're dissolving. We're doing something. We're dissolving the understanding. In the fourth stage, we let go of doing anything. For as long as the enemies or robbers of characteristics and thoughts do not arise, in other words, for as long as you can remain in this state where you're not doing anything in any way, consciousness or the mind should rest. Then, when wishing to arise from this meditation, slowly open the cross-legged position and stand up. And then, with an illusion-like frame of mind, perform as many positive actions with body, speech, and mind as possible. So this is how to then re-engage with the world, re-engage into the world. So taking, viewing things as illusion-like in the sense of not being truly existent, the way that we previously thought of them, but still being as helpful as we can in any way that we can, given whatever the situation is, by practicing with devotion, with perseverance for a long time and uninterruptedly. So continually applying yourself to this, whether it's within meditation or post-meditation. Those with proper fortune, those with sort of good karma of having encountered these teachings, of having the leisure to practice, of having the faculties intact, and so on and so forth, which all of us have, those precious qualities of precious human birth, free and well-favored. Therefore, we will see reality in this very lifetime. In other words, we will experience liberation. All phenomena are revealed as effortlessly and spontaneously present of their own accord, just like the middle of space. Through the wisdom that is attained subsequent to the meditative act of pose described, all phenomena are known as illusions and the like. So after we get up from meditation, where we experience this very dramatic state of going beyond any mental conceptualization or structure in any way, then when we again encounter the experience of subject and object, the conscious mind engaging with objects, the wisdom that arises is the wisdom of subsequent attainment, subsequent to meditative equipoise, where we understand the subject and object are not two different things, are non-dual. So subsequent wisdom. Thereby all phenomena are known as illusions, and the like are known to be like illusions. And from it, we don't say they are illusions, because we don't say that they are anything. We say that they're like illusions as an analogy, or used as a way of letting go, just like the analogy of space. In the time of having manifested the Vajra-like meditative concentration onwards, these bodhisattvas do not even have a phase of subsequent attainment, but rest in meditative equipoise at all times. So, the Vajra-like samadhi occurs at the end of the 10th bhumi, the entrance into the path of no more learning. So at that point, the distinction between the equipoise of meditation and the post-meditation experience blend into one, and there's no difference. So if you'll assume your cross-legged position and pick an object. We picked a book before. You could pick whatever object you'd like. Start with a object of form, of matter. I'm going to use the computer in front of me, this thing that I think is a computer. So I call it a laptop computer. You know, it's commonly referred to. It applied to the analysis of reduction ad absurdum, trying to find any sort of essential part of it that makes it a computer, and that if you took that one part away, it would no longer be whatever that object is. So identify your object. Also, relax into shamatha for starters. Just breathe in a relaxed way. Open up your mind, your senses. Feel the space in the room. Be aware of the space in front of you, which is easy to be aware of because we keep our eyes open so we see the space in front of us. Then be aware of the space behind you, which is a little more difficult because most of us don't have eyes in the back of our head. But you can sense the space behind you without using eyeballs. And in that way, you've opened up and experienced a sort of 360-degree awareness. Within that, you relax deeply onto your seat, whatever seat it is. Connect with a sense of release that happens on the out-breath. And because you've opened up to that 360-degree awareness, thoughts have very little impact on your mind. There's no sense of being drawn away from anything, from anywhere, by anything, to go anywhere, because there is no you that goes anywhere, because you're not holding on to some center. Identify your object, delineate it in space, with whatever characteristics you find in that object that help you identify where it begins and where it ends, what it is. Mentally dissect it. Taking it apart bit by bit, seeing at what point it no longer is whatever it was. And relax. After each of the stages, of the first two stages, relax. And then apply the second stage and look at your mind. Be aware that your mind has a past, thinks that it has a past and a future. It was the mind that was thinking about this and that before the exercise. The mind that we think that we'll engage in after the exercise. And we think we have a mind right now that's doing the exercise. And we try to find that mind. Is there a place where that mind resides? Is it in the head? above the head, within the feet. If it's in a particular place, does it have a shape, a size? Unable to find the location, size, and shape of our mind, we relax and let go of this feeling of there being a mind. And experience the space-like quality of the luminous emptiness that was what we called mind. And then we're left with an awareness of the experience of or understanding of emptiness. Step three. Where does that understanding reside? Did that understanding have a function? Did it overcome some other entity? That understanding itself burns itself up. And we relax and release on the out-breath, expanding in all directions. And expanding in that way, we let go of any fixed ideas of anything at all, any attempt to be present or not present, to be mindful or not, or to engage with anything or not. We lose track completely of ourselves, the room we're in, the sounds that you're hearing, that you thought were my voice, the meaning that you assigned to them dissolves, and you faint into complete absence of conceptuality, absence of mental structure. Every time the robbers and enemies in the form of thoughts, identifications of anything arise, just release them. Dissolve back into that place of not knowing. And then come back solely for the purpose of remembering this experience in a way that you can then recollect it throughout the rest of your day, throughout the rest of your life. And reside without fixation in this place of no place, and be as helpful as you can, in whatever way you find appropriate. Back in the realm of time and space, it's 9:18. Since we don't have a commute, we could take a couple of minutes for any comments or questions. I've unmuted most of you.
Derek, are there a set of slogans that we could use to remember those contemplations?
Yes. That's a good question. What slogans might we use?
What? Are you trying to ask me about the Lojong sayings?
Who is this Lojong?
Five of the Lojong sayings.
What are they?
Well, the first one, I can't remember.
Oh, that's a good slogan. Anybody else help her out, Chris?
Actually, I do remember it.
Oh, okay. Go for it.
It's to reflect on the four immeasurables, I think.
Anyone else remember the precise wording? So we're talking about the Lojong slogans that were made famous by Atisha. He didn't really come up with them, but he got all the credit because he did the marketing. As usual, that's what happens. Does anyone remember the slogan, the actual slogans? Or do you want to give another try, Mary Beth? You have the essence of it, but.
Yeah, something about the preliminaries.
Yeah, what should we do about the preliminaries?
We should train in them first.
Yeah, we should train in the preliminaries. What a great idea. And then
regard all dharmas as dreams.
Guard all dharmas as dreams. So that's experiencing all, basically all matter. It's similar to the first step of Atisha, regarding all things with matter as being empty. And then what's the second slogan?
Realize the nature of unborn awareness.
That's the import of it, but I think it's not the actual specific wording that we use. Isn't it more something like
examine
the nature of unborn insight, right? But it has the import that you just said of sort of recognizing or realizing the emptiness of insight, meaning the understanding, the subject, the perceiver. So that's experiencing step two of Atisha, which is the emptiness of the mind. And then with the next slogan.
Liberate the antidote.
So liberate the sense of having understood emptiness. And then?
In post-meditation.
No, there's one more before post-meditation.
Yet. Right, don't go there yet. I'm getting ahead of myself. Let's see.
It has something to do with what we're going to do after class is over.
Rest
in nature of Alia.
That's right.
Rest in the nature of Alia.
Right.
So that's the fourth step of Atisha. Yes, in the nature of Ali, the essence. And then what's the fifth slogan, the next slogan of the absolute bodhicitta? The first slogan that you said, first train the preliminaries is point one, and then point two is the main practice, bodhicitta. And it starts with absolute bodhicitta, five slogans, the first four are meditative. And then the fifth one is post-meditation. And it starts with the words in post-meditation.
Be
a child of illusion.
Be a child of illusion. What a cool saying. In post-meditation, be a child of illusion. That means like your parents are a loser and you don't have to listen to them, right? You don't exist. Go away. Leave me alone. I remember reading that as a kid and I was like, yeah. You're not real.
it shows you that you can't teach these things to
you can't teach them to your kids, right?
Your parents. You can't teach them to your parents.
Oh, there you go.
That's right.
It depends which way you want to go. Anyway, yes, thank you, Chris. These are summed up like really helpfully in the slogans that I actually circulated at a class earlier in this course, the five slogans as the basis for contemplation. So I'll circulate that again, but that sums up Atisha's text in a very nice way. And so you see the progression of the practice. So like first experiencing, regard all dharmas as dreams. It's slightly different than his version that we just read through, which is matter. He does matter and mind, you know, some way of like doing all phenomena. He does matter and mind. The slogans does objects, regard all dharmas as dreams, and then regard the perceiver, investigate the nature of unborn awareness. So just some way of sort of summing up in the first two steps all phenomena, and then the third step, realizing that experience of understanding emptiness, that experience itself needs to be let go of, and then learning how to rest. It's not easy to rest. You know, we've been taught since the moment we were born to do, to achieve, to accomplish. And so resting without falling asleep is, as we all know from meditation, is a challenging thing. And Talopa had some famous saying about resting, his six slogans, you know, don't do this, don't do that. I can't remember them, but you can look that up. He gives some instructions on how to rest. So anyway, I think we should probably dedicate anything else that was helpful, Chris. Thanks. Anything
I can like give that? You the Quilopa things. No thought, no reflection, no analysis, no cultivation, no intention. Let it settle itself. That's one of the translations of Talopa's points.
Thank you. Boom. Good.
It's always on my shrine.
Right. So we have one more class next week, and then I think everyone's agreement will do this book by Longchenpa, which is like one of his greatest classics. This new translation has come out. So I hope you want to participate, and I hope you do. Please obtain a copy of that. I'll show you what it looks like.
Derek, is there a sense of when that would begin?
Yeah. That would begin sometime after tonight. So then the question is when should that begin? Next week is the last class. Should we start the week after? Should we have a 1 week hiatus? Should we have a 2 week or 3 week or 4 week hiatus? What do folks say, think?
Well, we have to read. You have to decide on what the reading is, the first reading.
Right.
So maybe there
after
should be...
After one, hey, that's easy.
Yeah, but that book, I just looked on Amazon, and it's not immediately available.
Oh, no, what a problem.
Yeah, people have been stockpiling it.
I might be able to send a...
Bob is available.
It's not that they're not available, it's that they're not shipping until, like, I think my window, I just ordered it, and it's like my window for delivery is the 7th to the 14th, somewhere in there.
Yeah. Okay.
One month.
I'll contact Shambhala and see if they're still operating, if they can ship us some.
I might have an electronic copy, which maybe could be shared.
Yeah, the deal is you have to like prove that you've ordered it, and then we can give you the digital copy, which I have also.
Yeah, right. Want to be fair to the publishers and writers and translators and all that.
Well, is it available as on Amazon as a Kindle version? Or?
I think so, yeah.
Oh, so that can be downloaded.
Right, yeah, people could buy it that way too.
Yeah.
Cool. What if we pirate our own copy?
No, you have to pay. You have to pay for it.
Karma, okay. Folks. Karma, yeah. Remember?
You can make a donation directly to Padmakara, the translation committee. But Shambhala needs to get a piece of action, too, for publishing it, right?
That's the, okay.
Usually if you buy a hard copy from Amazon, you can start reading the Kindle copy right away for free. If people order it and it doesn't come for 2 weeks, that is an option too.
But not much of it. I don't know.
No, I thought you can't read the whole thing that way?
No. Some they do, some they don't, I think.
So you can't order it directly from the publisher?
The Kindle or the hard?
Just the book, yeah,
hard copy.
If their clothes not working, then they're not going to be able to ship. Then it would depend on Amazon's whether they have it in stock. You know. But why don't we have a week gap, a week off, after next week is like April, 7th or something, and then we'll start April 21. Something like that? Does that sound reasonably?
That sounds good.
At the apex.
Yeah. 21. Is that the apex? Oh, that's the apex. That apex.
21, yeah.
Okay.
All downhill after that.
So we all have to promise not to go outside between now and then, and to wash our hands a lot.
Yes.
What do you do? Do you have food delivered or do you go out to the store?
Mostly delivered. Well,
I go out at 6:30 in the morning. Twice a week.
Yeah.
And it's empty in my neighborhood anyway. Boy. It's the only time I go out.
Yeah.
A bizarre experience.
My daughter had hooked up one of those CSAs, the Community Supported Agriculture. Mm-hmm. So we're getting bags of fresh vegetables from some great stuff. Which is a good thing for, and she started that before this started, but we've been looking into it, but that's one source.
Do they deliver?
Yeah, they do, actually. We're kind of doing, what we're doing is a sort of a shared delivery where she gets mine and her together, that way it reduces the delivery cost a little bit.
Yeah, I heard that places like Fresh Direct, which you can order online, they're booked like weeks in advance, so
yeah, they must be overwhelmed.
Yeah.
And then for non-perishables, we've been finding alternative places like Vitacost and all sorts of other things, just to there's different, you can find all kinds of things, but they all you have to, everything's slower than usual.
Do you have any extra toilet paper?
Enough.
I'll send you a roll.
Yeah, just send me, for the next course, since we don't pay any rent, just send me toilet paper.
It's tough. It takes weeks sometimes before you find some on the shelf. It's crazy.
I've never had a problem finding toilet paper in the little grocery stores.
Actually, it's
in the neighborhood.
It's better to go to the little ones. The big ones are where people tend to hoard from, I think.
Right.
Anyway, let's hope that it ends very quickly and that not many more people suffer from this. I think we do our dedication with that intention. In the stormy days, the first old days,
sickness and death, from the ocean of samsara. May I free all beings.
By the confidence
of the golden sun of the great east. May the lotus garden of the Rigdon's wisdom bloom.
May the dark
sentient beings be dispelled. May all beings enjoy profound, brilliant glory.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Derek.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Derek.
Thank you, Derek.
Good night.
Good night.
Good
night. Stay well.
Can you do the thing with the recording, Emily?
What's that?
Can you convert the recording into audio?
Yeah, so I have to see what the deal is with this cloud situation, but I have a feeling I can just get it from the cloud, download it, and send it to you. So I'll do it tomorrow.
Thanks. No hurry. Thank you so much. Good night. Bye, everyone.
See you soon.
Thanks,
Bye.
Dad. Bye.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.